Well, hello and welcome to the May edition of the Aldi podcast presented by me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi. And in the May edition, we've got a wonderful piece by Robert Fox, who reported on the Falklands in 1982 and has returned and has written about the Battle of Goose Green. Now, Robert, can you first of all tell me why did you return?
Well, I went back on a commission because a friend of mine is making a feature film. It's an adventure story about that strange piece of action that took place at the end of May 1982 at Goose Green, which was fascinating. But I'm one of four technical consultants on it, and it was extraordinary to go back with three other participants who were absolutely there at the same time as I was, albeit they were combatants and I wasn't. And we saw it in extraordinary circumstances. And what we were doing, really, was walking the ground to help the director, John Irvin, with just orientating himself. Very interesting. The first thing he was struck by, and a very experienced film director, did the original Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Hamburger Hill, and so forth. He had not worked out how dramatic the landscape was. And it is dramatic. We could look over San Carlos Water, we went there, and we could see right out to the open sea, which in 1982, none of us possibly could, because it was rain, sleet, snow, rain, wind, all over again.
And to go back to Goose Green, we've all heard of the Falklands in 1982, we've all heard of Goose Green, but I think most listeners won't know exactly where Goose Green fitted in with the battle. It's a week after the landing at San Carlos, is that right?
It's significant that it's a week after the landing, because there was a great deal of anxiety in London, and actually in Washington, as it turned out as well, that nothing was moving and the winter was coming in, and the ground force, having landed on the 21st of May, would it be capable of really closing this one off before everything deteriorated, because the conditions were absolutely terrible. There was a commando brigade with five battalions. Two were attached, were parachute regiment battalions, and the politics of that is very interesting. There was a sort of loose rivalry always, and this is part of the mix of the plot of Goose Green. It was decided, the Americans had got terribly fed up and said to the Brits, you must get on, we've been supplying you with all this stuff. Two crucial ships had been lost within 3 days of the landing, HMS Coventry, but above all the Atlantic Conveyor, which was a huge container ship, which most of the tentage went down, half the helicopters went down with it. It was very dramatic. And the brigadier was ordered to get on with it, so he started marching most of his troops across the Falklands to Port Stanley, which is where you had to go, the capital. But meanwhile, to get a bit of gratuitous action, as it were, and it was never really well thought out, 2nd Battalion Parachute Regiment under Lieutenant Colonel H. Jones, very flamboyant character, was sent off to do their own thing. And it really was only in those terms. There is a garrison down in this settlement, very important settlement, which connected two crucial parts of East Falkland, had probably, very possibly, the biggest sheep station in the whole of the southern hemisphere there. Something like 250,000 sheep, all told, went through that place. And they said, well, you know, that he was told to go and suppress this thing, give them a bloody nose, but they hadn't thought it out at all. And he got himself into an extraordinary little battle that went on about five times longer than it was expected to. He was very much following his own script. He was killed in the action. And the paratroopers ran out of ammunition, about which we could say more. And they just about got there. And on the second day, somehow, by hook or by crook, 1,000 Argentines surrendered to about 450 paratroopers, which is...
And so was he a famous man, Colonel H. Jones, but was he, all due respect, but was he foolhardy?
There was something almost 19th century about him. He was half American, not that you would know that he was educated at Eton, but he was very much known for doing his own thing. He was a wealthy man in his own right, which is very much almost like the 19th century expeditionary armies of Crimea and India. I'm being cautious, but there was, should I say, a certain amount of personal rivalry between himself and the Royal Marines Brigadier Julian Thompson. It was something that really didn't come to the fore to the journalists, but anybody who knew that would see it there. So it was almost, who would rid me of this turbulent police? Oh, H, go off and do your own thing. Going back and having experienced quite a few things since, particularly with the British Army, and have done the courses for higher command and so on. It was run in a way that no battle would be run at all nowadays. And it was H. Jones going forward, one company after another, and the devil make the hindmost. The fact that they ran out of ammunition, the fact that there was no support from the brigade, the fact that the whole thing nearly collapsed in the middle, was absolutely fascinating. And for me, it was a seminal experience.
Because you were there, just to explain, you were there for the BBC radio, is that right?
I was the BBC radio correspondent. My late friend, our colleague, Brian Hanrahan, was television. He was miles away with the ships. This was the first land action, and by chance, myself and somebody called David Norris of the Daily Mail ended up in the middle of it. And by that, I really mean the middle of it, because we were with the second in command, who had to take over when H. Jones was killed, and we followed our own path through the battle as the forward companies were going through on this thing, roughly quality and the exposure of a giant billiard table, into the settlement of Goose Green. It was a very strange experience. There were some marvellous characters there. One of the crucial characters was a man commanding B Company, still a great friend, Johnny Crossland. He said, well, it is the ultimate come-as-you-are party, and it was come-as-you-are, make up your rules, or all sorts of things that should have been done rightly and just weren't done at all, including running out of ammunition.
And you say in your piece it was almost like the last war of a previous age, is that right?
Well, you're putting it in very good and straight journalistic terms. It was actually one of the people I was with, Clive Chapman, he was barely out of his teens in the battle. He'd just graduated, he'd just been through Sandhurst, and he was commanding a platoon with B Company at the time. And he looked at me as we were walking through the ground again, and he said, must have been very interesting for you, because, as he put it so beautifully, it's the last of the analogue wars. Although I could transmit from one or two ships by satellite communication, I just went off and did my own thing. I hardly spoke to the BBC. I certainly didn't take orders from them. The only communication I got in writing from them was a letter telling me I was underinsured. And you just went on and did it. It was terribly old-fashioned.
You didn't have a flak jacket?
And I had a rubbish helmet, but it fitted very comfortably. It was a cork helmet, which you use for parachute jumping. And the paras loved it, because they could cut a huge hole in the middle and they could put sort of three times the ration of morphine in it. They said, well, we don't care about you, mate, but you can carry two more, which you always did, for somebody else. No, nobody had body armour, nobody at all at that time. And in fact, two of the battles, they fought in soft berets.
And you said it could have been lost, like the Battle of Jutland, in an afternoon. The whole war could have been lost by the British.
I think there are certain people that know that. It just happened. It was very much organised. About 5 years after Margaret Thatcher left office, I was invited to a small lunch party because she wanted to talk to me about the Falklands, because she remembered vividly my voice. And it was the voice, I voiced the British troops going ashore, and she thought they weren't going to make it until I heard that. And she said, well, I thought it was going to be pretty good. And she said at the lunch to me that we were going to make it, therefore. And I said, well, no, you nearly lost it altogether in 2 hours, a week later at Goose Green. Now, she said to me, and I don't necessarily believe her, but she said to me, nobody's ever put it like that to me before. I talked to Charles Moore, her biographer, and he certainly didn't clock that. I mean, the whole thing, if the Paras had been driven back, and it would have been a mess, and surrendered, and there were quite high casualties. You were 17 British dead, but there were about 40, 50 wounded, all told, in the whole complex of the battle, and about twice or three times the number of killed and wounded on the Argentine side for various reasons. But a defeat would have been extremely bloody. It would have gone into reverse. There would have been the pressure to negotiate at the UN and to stop the whole thing, I think, would have been irresistible. So it very nearly did fall apart. And Thatcherism would have been stillborn before it was launched, almost. On that, she did the election, of course, in 1983, and so much is history.
And second only to the battle between Britain and Argentina was the battle between journalists to be the first into Port Stanley. What's the story about you and Max Hastings, and who was the first?
Well, I got on quite well with Max, and he employed me, and we both hatched cunning plans to get into Port Stanley. I mean, mine was much wilder and more hopeless. What I have to be quite careful here. Max didn't get on with the soldiers. Can I be quite blunt about
Despite
that?
Despite admiring soldiers more than anybody else.
He admired officers an awful lot. The trouble is, I got completely distracted, because the soldiers, the best of them, were extremely funny for a start. They quick-witted, sharp, and they ran the thing, as the best of the officers recognised. And I didn't sort of go around sort of troopy-groupy with them, but they used to run into me, and we had a very, very, very good chats and very rebarbative exchanges, so much so that the end of Goose Green, which was a real up and a down, all over the place thing, and the brilliant padre, the Reverend David Cooper, still quite a famous figure, and I think the only one of us who didn't go completely bonkers at the end of it. But the padre came to me and he said, the lad said to me to make sure that you would go through from Goose Green to Standin. They fought another battle. In fact, I was taken away because I was running effectively a local radio station. Everybody was listening to me on the artillery nets, were turned over to BBC World Service. Well, I said, David, is that on the basis of a loony like me can make it, they're going to make it? He said, pretty much on target. And I enjoyed the company. And I never really thought that Max saw that. He never got the web and the woof of the thing. And it was a very, very interesting group of people. They were all professionals. They were not particularly gung-ho. It was not sort of up your punter or yeah. a gotcha. The Sun, in fact, when the papers did arrive, as the troops were going down, they were really rather surprised at this sort of Mafeking night jingoism about it. And I say to a man, because there were a very few women, the women were in the Royal Naval Nursing Service. They were brilliant, they were absolutely fantastic. And a lot of the crew of the ships, like the Canberra, were women, and they were terrific too.
And in your piece, you also very beautifully lay out the fog of war at the time and how very hard it was to tell what was actually going on at Goose Green. Returning, did it become more clear?
Yes, but it was false memory. Chip Chapman, who was a bit of a know-all, frankly, I hope he won't ever say, so kept on saying, oh, Foxy, that's fake memory. But it's quite true, but you've really rather touched a thing, because one of the outtakes from doing the film is that they want me to do a documentary, a long memory, about reporting war. And there is this terrible business, and I mistrust these people who say, oh, I'm an action reporter, and then give you a terrific... And Max Hastings himself, not above this kind of thing. I was in it, therefore I know. No, you never know the combinations. It's like an elaborate... It's a sort of Douglas Adams combination lot for the whole thing. Even a simple action. For goodness sake, we should know what went on with Ed Goose Green. There were about 1,800 combatants, all told, involved in a night-day, night battle, which covered, at the most generous, the area of two municipal golf courses, not even links golf courses, and yet we don't know. I still stay in touch with lots of friends, like John Crossland and Philip Neame and so on, and we always come up with a new fact or a new factoid that we never realised that. Very interesting making the film. I was there with Chip, I was there with two guys, and it's basically their story, two paratroopers who went on to do extraordinary things later, one in C Company, the other in D. And they had no idea what had happened. I had some idea of the outlay of the battle, but they didn't know about the broadcast, the controversy of the broadcast, about where H went, and even what happened at the surrender, which was bizarre at the end, where I played a very, very minor part, and I'm guarding that very, very jealously when it comes to the movie.
Exactly. That's using your Italian to understand.
Yeah, they were half Italian, most of them. And, right. I had to do a lot of talking, because the thing got a bit out of control afterwards, because we had about 1,000 prisoners, and they were in the sharing sheds. Not a great one for broadcasting, yeah, that one. Yeah. But they were the shearing sheds, and they weren't disgusting, but they were not all that salubrious, and they were desperate to get away. And I remember having to explain to them, actually, you don't realise there are very, very few helicopters, and we need helicopters to get you, first of all, to San Carlos, and then eventually back to Argentina. And I went back with 4,000 of them to Argentina, and have never been near Argentina, sadly, since. I'd like to have done. But Chris Keeble, who was desperate at that time, used to send me in to talk to them. They accepted it. Most of them had, it's like the Pope, had an Italian granny or an Italian mother or so on, and it worked. I mean, most of them were extremely reasonable. They were really rather gentle souls, didn't know why the hell they were there. There were about a slack handful of 24, and I haven't said this in the article, but I still feel very strongly about it, real nasties who had been involved in the dirty war. One was identified by a Red Cross officer I was with as being involved in the torture center in the Marine Engineering School of Infamy in Cordoba and so on. But it was very interesting, extraordinary piece of exposure, because I've done a lot since, I've done a bit before, but to be culturally so much at the centre of a drama, and it was particularly in the isolation of Goose Green, is really quite extraordinary and doesn't really happen very often in a journalistic career.
And despite that, you say one of the few things you're sure about is that Goose Green was a complete bloody fluke.
Oh, yeah, a roll of the dice the other way, because when The Light came up, Jones's plan was far too elaborate, and the plan that he gave at dusk the Thursday was that it would all be done and dusted by noon on the Friday. It was barely done and dusted by noon, and it was very rainy and wet, the surrenders and so forth, by noon the following day. If the Argentines had been better organised and had realised that the forward companies, that's the leading 300 of the Paras, really were desperately low with ammunition, things could have been really bad. But what I've been reading back from experience, and it's wrong to, I've talked to colleagues and friends of Jones, so they just never planned things in that way. The ammunition resupply was tenuous, to put it mildly. From brigade, the sense of reinforcement was minimal. They only had 3 artillery guns, 2 mortar tubes. I mean, it was pretty strange. But I think it was the sheer willpower of the soldiers in the front line that really did it. But it really was absolutely a fluke, yeah.
Very intriguing. And you also write very movingly about returning and seeing the peaceful side of the Falklands now in the Sea Cabbage Cafe with all the cruise tourists who come and visit it. Could you tell us about that?
Well, the Sea Cabbage was quite near another really rather dramatic scene. It was near Bluff Cove, where the Galahad and the Tristram with the Welsh Guards were bombed, and they were very badly beaten up there. But from well before, Bluff Cove Farm had been run by people who really are quite friends of mine, Kevin and Hattie Kilmartin. They weren't married. There was a different arrangement. Yeah. Let's say Kevin was married before. But Kevin bought, he's a barrister. His uncle, Terence, was a famous journalist on The Observer. Yeah, with yeah, it. Yeah. And he just said, well, I got fed up with it all. And he did everything, including being postmaster on South Georgia, bought the place in 1971, this farm. And with it, he got his own penguin colony with the Delhi and Kings, but particularly lovely King Penguin. And now that's a real money earner. And they are absolutely cutting edge of Falklands tourism. What Falklands tourism? An island of 3,500 inhabitants has 60,000 tourist day visitors a year, because they come on the cruise island, they go around, they see Stanley, go to the museum, it's pretty good, and they go to this wonderful little paradise, they see their private penguin show, they have the most wonderful cream tea. It's a sort of Dorset cream tea which is nearly blown away in these huts, because the next time you would have a landfall, if you were blown away, you'd probably be in Antarctica. And it's just superbly done, but there's a lot of good entrepreneurial stuff going on in the Falklands. The services, who make quite a large garrison of about 1,000, moan all the time, oh, it costs so much in fuel and so on. And I had to point out to them, I said, as long as there's a Conservative Member of Parliament in UK, you're not going to get rid of the Falklands, so get on with it. But they are prospering. They're making a lot of, not greedy sums of money, but they've got a heritage fund of about 400 million and they're building schools. The educational
money from oil and fish, is that right?
It's mostly the long squid, which brings in 22 million revenue a year, but oil is coming on and they're bracing for it, because then things will have to change enormously. Unfortunately, the way things are, although they're slightly better at the moment, it will mean more trouble with Argentina. But for the sort of oldie audience, the great thing about the Falklands is that you're on the doorstep of Antarctica. The wildlife is fabulous. And if we can get the cruises, they're just beginning now, you can go from Montevideo, you go down to the Falklands, you go to South Georgia, see a little bit of Antarctica, come up the coast of Patagonia, you will see wildlife that is the kind of thing that Samuel Taylor Coleridge recorded in The Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. I have seen and flown above in an army helicopter flotilla of albatross with a wingspan of nearly 2 meters. Enormous, extraordinary beast. And it is wild, it is fresh, and oh boy, you do feel the hole in the ozone layer there, because you get scorched up. But it is becoming increasingly a venue for quality tourism as well. People go to West Falkland, they pay about £18,000 to have 2 weeks there and see species that they'll only see once in their lifetime.
Well, it sounds like the perfect destination for ancient oldie mariners. I'm extremely grateful to Robert Fox for his oldie podcast and for his delightful article in the May issue of the magazine. Thank you so much.